Welcome. We'll begin the meeting of the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee meeting for Tuesday, March 9th. This is deadline week, so members will be coming and going as they have bills to present and other committees too, myself included. And we'll begin the meeting with Senate File 2616, Senator Kathy Sharon.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee for taking time to listen to this bill. What we're doing here, just for context, this is a telecommunications private shared service regulation that really is an old statute that's being reinstated and then updated to recognize that we need to include some language related to broadband. And what I'd like to do is walk you through the bill and introduce you to Carrie Rice, who is with the Regulatory Affairs Administration for Hickory Tech, a company in my home community of Mankato, and Randy Young, who's the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And they are available to answer very specific questions you may have about the bill. So just to walk you through the bill, this is, in Section 1, a bill that defines private shared services for the purposes of this section. I just want to make sure that you know that the language was confusing to me, private shared services, but it really relates to the provision of telephone or video programming services or broadband services, which we've added, by a private provider within a complex or a building where they're providing that as a part of their services to a group who rent in that building or perhaps who are in a nursing home facility. That would be a private shared service that's offered to those tenants or to those persons in the building. So that's what the first subdivision is, the definition of private shared services. Subdivision 2 requires property owners that have these private shared systems to establish within their facility a demarcation point for other companies, other telephone companies that provide local exchange services to enter and to set up their system in that building. It specifies the telephone company and the private shared system owner operator obligations. That's in the requirements listed in Subdivision 2. Subdivision 3 describes the tenant's rights to an alternative provider besides the shared services that are offered by the owner of the building. Subdivision 4 gives the Public Utilities Commission enforcement authority over the section by requiring the shared service provider to allow access. Subdivision 5 exempts the shared services provider from a statute that really is set up for regular telephone companies. It's competitive language and does not apply to shared services and should not. Subdivision 6 refers to requirements of a telephone company to provide service requested by a tenant through the local exchange and to be willing to offer that service to anyone located with, even though they're in a shared service building, if they request that. That is the essence of the building, of the bill, and with that, as you prefer, would you like our testifiers to speak to the bill now, or do you want simply to take questions?
Why don't we have the testifiers speak first?
Thank you. Then we'll begin with Carrie Rice.
Okay,
Actually,
Rice.
Begin with Randy.
We'll begin with
Mr. Young.
Never mind.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randy Young with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We like to refer to this as the Sunrise Bill in that it resurrects a bill that sunsetted a number of years ago after everyone thought that the issue was dead and gone. We're now finding that there are situations, however, where there is a need for the PUC to become involved in situations where any provider may not be allowed into a building where there are multiple tenants, in order to provide the tenants with a choice of providers for telephone, for broadband, and for video services. This bill, this portion of the act in Chapter 237 was originally passed back in the mid-80s. There were very few problems. I think just the threat of the act at that point was enough to take care of the problem that it was originally intended to address. And that was, as you may recall, when divestiture originally occurred and the Bell Company was broken up, competition was just beginning, and there was a concern among a lot of the new entrants into the marketplace that the large existing incumbent telephone companies may try to keep competitors out of large buildings. The original act was intended to allow anyone who wanted to come in and provide service to do that. Over a period of time, it was evident that this was no longer needed, that the marketplace was taking care of itself. So in the 90s, this, along with a number of other pieces of Chapter 237, were sunsetted. We now find that not necessarily is another competitor or player in the marketplace prohibiting competition or prohibiting tenants from having a choice of providers, but in some cases, the building owner or the landlord is cutting a deal with one provider to the detriment, we think, of the tenants, because they cannot then have a choice of who they may want for their internet provider or their video or their phone provider. This basically reinstates the language that was sunsetted back in the 90s, updating a little bit, including broadband, which obviously was not an issue when the original statute was passed. Carrie Rice from Hickory Tech led our work group that worked on this legislation. I'll turn it over to her for more details.
Ms. Rice.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Rice, and I'm here today representing Hickory Tech. And I'll share with you very briefly why my company supports this bill and encourages its passing today. I recognize that some of you may be wondering who or what the heck is Hickory Tech, so I'll tell you very quickly. We're a diversified communications company headquartered in Mankato on Hickory Street, as a matter of fact. Not the most creative name, but we also have offices in Plymouth, Minneapolis, and Duluth. We have 450 employees, and we're the largest phone company headquartered in Minnesota. By diversified, I mean that we are the incumbent local telephone company. We've served Blue Earth County for over 115 years. We're also a competitive telephone company, bringing choice to 8 rural communities in southern Minnesota. We are a competitive cable TV provider, again, providing choice to customers, and we are also a fiber-based wholesale transport provider. I mentioned competitive choice in the description of my company because that, to us, is what this bill is about. Mankato, as you know, is a college town. There's a high concentration of rental properties. For the last 3 summers, beginning in August, when the students start to trickle back, Hickory Tech has faced the issue of being denied access to a complex of buildings owned by one building owner in particular. This management company owns 90 apartment buildings in Mankato, and they have categorically refused us access to install or to repair services to customers requesting our phone, broadband, and digital TV. Coincidentally, this management company also offers high-speed internet and television programming services to their residents. Under this bill, they would be a shared services provider. So, Hickory Tech is accustomed to operating in a competitive environment, and we believe that consumers' ability to choose their provider needs to be protected, and Senate File 2616 would make that very clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Senator Sparks.
Madam Chair, if there's no questions, I do have the A2 amendment.
That is on the desk. Do you have a copy of that, Senator Sharon?
I do not.
Okay.
Thank you. I do now.
Would you like to describe that for us?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. This is a technical amendment to a bill that we passed into law last year dealing with the competitive business lines, 4 or more business lines. In the meantime, there was a Court of Appeals case that was involving AT&T and had nothing really to do with the legislation that we passed here. They said that this could affect it. So this is clarifying language, and maybe Ms. Rice could help me explain a little bit more if we need more detail.
Because I was also chair of that committee last year. Thank you. This language is just to simply clarify that apparently the Department of Commerce was concerned that AT&T case would require us to make a tariff filing for every contract offering that we did for these businesses with 4 or more lines. This language would clarify that those do not need to be filed, that we can just offer those on a relatively deregulated basis.
Questions or comments on the amendment? Senator Dibble.
I'm sorry, which amendment is this?
A2.
A2.
Yeah.
Oh, I did have a question, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't. I have
okay.
a question
anybody
on something
here
else
from the PUC
up.
Or anybody that could offer an opinion on this?
Madam Chair, I don't see anyone from the department of the. Oh, here we go. Madam Chair, Dan Wolf, Assistant Executive Secretary with the Public Utilities Commission.
Mr. Wolf.
We've had a chance to look at this language, and the people that I've talked to, the staff there, they don't see a problem with this. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Questions or comments? Okay. Then on Senator Sparks' A2 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion? Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, I have the A3 amendment.
Yeah, and everybody have a copy of that? Senator Sharon, have you looked at it?
I'm willing to listen.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
Well, Madam Chair, this is makes a rather obvious change in the fact that there's about 150 long-distance providers offering service in the state of Minnesota, and in the problem has been that you needed to have approval from the PUC before you disconnect the long-term long-distance service from the reseller. And this allows the long-distance provider to disconnect without going through the PUC. So it makes it a lot simpler, the method of doing it for these multiple suppliers. And we do have somebody from the industry that could speak, a person named Scott Mulder, if you'd like to have any questions answered.
Mr. Mulder. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Scott Bowler. I'm with Frontier, with the B, Frontier Communications. Frontier is the second largest incumbent local exchange carrier in Minnesota. And I would like to speak briefly in support of this amendment. As was mentioned, it will kind of simplify the regulatory process in dealing with long-distance resellers that don't pay their bills to their underlying wholesale provider or telephone company. Under current law, a carrier would need to go to the PUC to get approval to disconnect that type of carrier that hadn't paid their bills. As you can imagine, this can be a lengthy process. In the meantime, that reseller is racking up bills that it won't pay. And leaving the telephone company or the wholesale provider on the hook for that for those funds. Removing this potentially lengthy requirement for a regulatory process will minimize the losses that telephone companies could see from delinquent resellers. At one time, there may have been a need for the PUC to review these kinds of disconnections to make sure there was no problem with availability of a long-distance service to end users. As was mentioned, there's well over 100 long-distance providers now, so the issue of long-distance availability to customers is really not a problem anymore. So customers can easily find a new provider if their current provider cannot provide service any longer. In short, Frontier supports this amendment, and I would take any questions.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
This is the one I had a question about. A representative of the industry did intercept me in the hallway and explained this, and I'm sympathetic to their dilemma, you know, being able to disconnect, you know, those long-distance providers that aren't paying their bills. I support that, but my question was, and I understand this primarily is in the instance of businesses, and so I worry about the business who shows up one day and their long-distance service has been disconnected for this reason, not through any fault of their own, they're paying their bills, but their long-distance provider's not paying their bills to the local carrier. So there may be a day or two of delay at the business, you know, and it may be a critical business function, long-distance service. So how do we address that issue? Do we provide fair warning to folks ahead of time that if you're contracting with a long-distance carrier who's not good at paying their bills to us, then someday you might show up and not have your long-distance service? Or I understand that the local carrier can't contact a customer because it's not their direct customer. So it's a dilemma, someone showing up one day not having their long-distance service. Is that a valid concern?
Is it Mr. Older?
Bowler.
Bowler.
B-O-H-L-E-R.
Bowler, okay.
If I may, that is a valid concern. There is language in the statute today that requires long-distance carriers to give notice to their customers if there are rate changes or increases or they're disconnecting, or I should say discontinuing service. So there's existing language in the statute now that would require the long-distance carrier to notify their customers that this change is occurring.
I have a concern that this seems very broad, and it seems like there should be some breach of a contract or something before you could disconnect them. And it doesn't specify that here that I can tell.
Generally, the contractual obligation between the reseller and the phone company would contain language that would, you know, give the legal steps or if there
right,
was
but
disputed.
it should state so in the language of the amendment. Something to the effect that if they don't pay their bills, that this could be enacted, or not just you can just cut them off for any reason, whatever.
You know, pursuant to whatever contractual obligations or parameters there were.
Madam Chair, if I might, services to these companies are provided under our tariffs that are on file with the Public Utilities Commission, and they do have those terms and conditions in there under which services will be disconnected, particularly for non-payment. And those include giving notice to the person being disconnected. And
well, my question, Ms. Rice, is there a reference to that in this language so that the statute is clear that you have to follow the contract?
Well, if I may, I mean, if
Mr. Bowler,
if the phone company took an action to disconnect that was in conflict with their contractual obligations, you know, the long-distance carrier would have legal recourse to ensure that the contracts were enforced.
Senator John Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am concerned, too, about this particular provision, especially on the business side of it, where, you can find another carrier, but, a disruption in business like this could cost thousands of dollars in a delay. I'm wondering if there shouldn't be a provision in here that not just they can – or, you know, decide, well, we're going to disconnect, but that there maybe there's a notification to the PUC that we intend to, as a business, disconnect that service, you know, 7 days from now or something like that, so that the PUC is notified, since we're eliminating the need to go through this process through with the Public Utilities Commission, but at least notify them that that's going to happen. Does that make any sense?
So, Senator Dahl, who are you suggesting needs to send the notice?
Well, the communications carrier that's going to, you know, turn off the service or disconnect the service, that they would contact the PUC that they intend to discontinue that service as a result of non-payment from that carrier, but at least notify the PUC that that's what they intend to do.
I think that the PUC worked on this, and I'm wondering if there's somebody that would like to speak to it from the Public Utilities Commission.
Madam Chair, Dan Wolf again.
Mr. Wolf again.
And I can't, you know, Mr. Fuller might be able to help me out a little bit on the exact nuances here, but obviously Mark Oberlander was the one that worked on this specifically, and he's not here today, but I know that this language is different than the language that we saw in the other body. There, the language was dealing with long-distance service only so that there was local service available. And questions did arise as to notice to customers in that situation who are losing service. But beyond that, I mean, obviously the commission will do whatever the legislature directs them to do.
Yeah, do you know?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Excuse me, just a minute. Mr. Fuller has some comments.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I got a piece of paper that said Mr. Oberlander had signed on and off on this, but I haven't seen it. But it strikes me that the language on lines 15 to 17 really go to the ability of the commission to require the continuation of service. And so they are stripped of that authority, even if they would find it in the public interest. So it seems like it's not the smoothest transition between the thought that telephone companies that are not paying their bills to the servicing company, they don't have to be connected if they're not paying their bills. Because what the bill says is that even if that this public interest finding by the commission doesn't exist in those circumstances where the provider is only certified to provide long-distance service. So I'm not sure that the language reflects the clear intent anyway, or not as clearly as it could.
Senator Carlson, I'm going to ask you to remove the amendment. And the reason is I think it needs a good public hearing, and we don't have the time on a deadline week to give it that hearing. So I would ask you respectfully to remove the amendment.
Madam Chair, at your request, I withdraw the amendment.
Thank you. Any further discussion about the bill? And Senator Sheridan, you have a motion.
I move Senate File 2616 as amended.
Be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. On that motion, any discussion? And all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next bill is Senator Tomasoni, and I'm going to turn the chair over to Senator Dahl.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing my bill. Senate File 2676 is a bill relating to solar photovoltaic rebates. And not only is this bill a bill for the creation of green manufacturing jobs in Minnesota, but it's also to encourage the use of solar panels or solar voltaics through the use of a rebate program. The program is successful in other states, and one of the reasons it's successful is that the payback on solar panels oftentimes is takes a long time, or the cost of installing them is prohibitive, so that trying to pay for them up front is difficult. And this program tries to do is try to encourage people to put up solar panels and be able to have them pay them off like within a 5-year period. And when you go into that type of a time frame for payback on these solar panels, they suddenly become something that is very doable for people, and can advance our green economy and in the use of solar panels and trying to reduce some of the use of our carbon fuels. So I think it's a pretty good program, and the idea behind it is to use the Renewable Energy Fund for the funding source. And I'll turn this over now to, who wants to go, Mr. Cervenic, or you want to go first, Gary? Mr. Cervenic, to explain a little bit more of how it would actually work.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Mr. Cervenic, if you just for the record, identify yourself and then your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Cervenic. I've been consultant with the Mountain Air and EDA, Economic Development Authority. And in our work to create jobs in our little community in northeastern Minnesota, we've recruited a solar modular manufacturing company that currently has a plant in the state of Washington, which has a similar rebate program. And with me, who will testify after me, is John Carroll, who represents that facility. We're seeking this legislation to provide an additional incentive to Xcel Energy ratepayers to have a $5 per installed watt rebate program. It would come out of the RDF fund. I think the money that we have in here might be a little bit high for the amount of money available in that fund, and I think that would be addressed at a different point in the process. However, it's clear that to get solar installed to residential customers in Minnesota, you need to somehow provide an incentive that reaches the 5 to 6 year payback period. It's very difficult for an average consumer or homeowner to be paying $40,000 to install solar on their home and have a 19-year payback period, which is what would be the current rate at the installed cost. And so this bill attempts to address that by providing an additional incentive if a consumer actually purchases a panel from a Minnesota manufacturer. And that's the key difference in this program. It's, in effect, a super rebate to encourage jobs in manufacturing in Minnesota. In addition, the bill provides some specific language that helps an existing company in Minnesota, 10K Solar, and I think they would like to testify after we're done, makes them eligible for this program, as with our program, which requires specific manufacturing techniques, which would encourage actually job creation and not merely assembly of parts produced in other countries in Minnesota. And so I think that gives an overview of it, and perhaps Mr. Carroll, if you could add.
Okay, Mr. Carroll, welcome to the committee. If, again, for the record, if you could identify yourself.
Okay, my name is John Carroll. I'm a vice president with Newport Partners. We are the owner of Silicon Energy, which is probably the only PV module manufacturer in the state of Washington. It's been our experience in the state of Washington that under a similar sort of incentive, state incentive, that basically an area of the country which previously was neglected suddenly is catching fire with regard to PV module manufacturing. We started off with one line. We now have two lines going full-time, and we're having a hard time keeping up with orders. The state of Minnesota to date has installed about 1 megawatt of solar panels, which compared to the rest of the country, it's at about 9,000 megawatts. So the state of Minnesota is pretty far behind where other states are with regard to solar. Looking at this from a financial standpoint, the reason why is because, as Gary mentioned, when we run the numbers with the existing rebate programs that you have with Xcel, with the state rebate program, and with the voluntary programs from Minnesota Power and other utilities, the rebate or the payback period is usually between 15 and 19 years. It's been our experience that if you get that down to between a 5 and 7 year period of time for both residential, commercial, and industrial customers, that usually ignites the market. And that's what we've done here. We've tried to establish a subsidy for a Minnesota-manufactured panel to basically give a buyer of panels an incentive to basically put them on their house. Other than that, I can say that, I've been working up on the Minnesota-Mesabi Iron Range with Senator Tomasoni for about 5 to 7 years now on various projects, and we feel very comfortable, very strongly about manufacturing in the USA, we intend to make this plant as efficient as possible and expand it and take advantage of whatever subsidies there are now, but the intent is basically a long-term commitment to the state of Minnesota and to manufacturing here.
Thank you. Mr. Carroll, is your plant under construction now, already built, or is it planned?
There's a plant in Arlington, Washington that is already built, yes.
And as far as Minnesota is concerned, do you have a plant that you're going to build here?
We're considering building, if we can get this legislation passed and we can see a commitment that is a multi-year commitment to subsidize solar panels in the state, yes, we will build and operate a plant up in Mountain Iron.
Another question I have for you, Mr. Carroll, is in Washington, you said they're running a similar program, mm-hmm. And it's for solar panels that are manufactured in Washington. Is that how the program works?
That's correct.
Okay. And was there any question about any kind of Commerce Clause constitutionality with putting those kind of that language into statute?
I know it came up, but basically the way it was resolved was anybody could build a plant to manufacture PV modules in the state of Washington, and we already have a competitor here in 10K Solar who's already an established PV module manufacturer.
Okay. Senator Thomas-Oney, do you know how much is in this fund right now currently?
Maybe Mr. Cervenek knows.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Cervenek.
I believe that there is a $15 million planned in an upcoming fiscal year, either this year or next year, that's available in what's called the fourth funding cycle. Since its institution in 94, roughly $16 million has been deposited annually in the fund. The fund has commitments to the University of Minnesota IRE account, I believe, of roughly $5 million per year. And I believe the REPI payments are roughly $10 million per year. And then the fund builds up to a certain level, and the RDF fund board reviews that and asks for RFPs for grants from that fourth funding cycle, which I believe they're planning on sending out in future, either this year or next year. I'm not an expert on that, but I believe that's the amount that would be available. In addition, in future years, 2 years after this, there would be a $4.9 million, in effect, surplus in the fund that would be targeted towards that grant program. And in addition to that, in 2014, the state fiscal year, $3.5 million would be available on an annual basis due to increased revenue from more CAS at Monticello. I believe that testimony is fairly accurate.
Mr. Cervenek, in that those numbers that you're quoting, I'm looking at $5 million appropriated annually for the next 5 years. So if it's the $3.5 million you're talking about, that would be above and beyond what the $5 million that you're looking to pull out of that fund? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe the amount that we have in the bill, as you see it, is too rich for the content of the funds right now, and we would have to work with Senator Anderson and other members to come up with better figures that wouldn't deplete the grant program and wouldn't hurt other funds, and that's what we would be working with others on.
Senator Anderson, do you have any thoughts on this matter?
Well, this bill will go to my division or to finance after this, and we'll have to give it some consideration and take a look. I think Mr. Cervenek is pretty accurate in how he laid out the fund. There's a lot of obligations, and some of them are phasing out and some are longer term. So we'd have to look carefully at that. Now, I thought I heard somebody say something about Xcel ratepayers getting rebates. And so does this limit this to, because Xcel ratepayers are the ones who pay into the fund?
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, he did say that, but we didn't put the amendment on the bill yet. And so okay. We have to put that amendment on the bill. In fact, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, we'd like to put the A2 amendment on the bill.
Okay, is this the first stop for this bill, Senator Thomas?
This is the first stop, yes.
Senator Thomas-Oney, can you explain what that amendment does?
I think I can, but I'm going to let.
Does everyone have a copy of that?
I'm going to let Mr. Cervenek do it because I'm pretty sure I know what it does.
A2?
So I don't want to make
the
sure.
It's the A2 amendment.
I don't
amendment,
want to say anything inaccurate, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Cervenek.
Our standard amendment.
Excel amendment.
All right. Well, this is your first stop. Just as an author's amendment, no, to get in the shape you want. Let's just move the as an author's amendment. Any questions from the members? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Thomas-Oney.
Okay. Do you want to know what that did?
Yeah, if you could.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
What happened?
Members.
Chair?
I'd rather not tell you. But
one moment. General scene.
I just want to be sure on procedure because Senator Thomas-Oney is not part of the committee. So I'd like to move that if it would have had to been moved by one of us. So let the record.
The record will say Senator Olstein moved the,
thank you, Senator Olstein,
the amendment.
Moved by the author, no matter what committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment basically on line 1.2 further defines and prohibits any sale at retail or wholesale. It has to be sold back to the utility, and this is a standard language that most of these bills have in there. And then this, I get, excuse me, that was the line 1.8. line 1.2 requires that this rebate only be available to XL ratepayers because the money into the XL redevelopment fund comes from XL ratepayers, so it narrows the definition of eligibility in Minnesota to the XL service territory. So those are the two things that the amendment does.
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I think
Senator Tomasoni?
I think there's an A4 amendment that you're interested in.
Yes, there is. Was there any questions or comments from members regarding the original amendment, A2 amendment? And I, there is another amendment, it's the A4.
I'll move it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble?
I'll move the A4 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble moves the A4 amendment.
And as I understand the A4 amendment, it would add language to paragraph B, kind of defining what we're talking about in terms of manufacturing in Minnesota. So it's not construed so narrowly as to be construed as to only serving one particular company, but is about Minnesota manufacturing of solar voltaic.
Members, that amendment comes from the language. Actually, I was originally going to move that amendment. I have a solar manufacturer in my district that has some technology that's kind of the cutting edge, and we want to make sure that we have, you know, language that allows for existing manufacturers that have, you know, things that aren't in maybe the traditional definition of solar panels. That they can be allowed to participate in this program, and that's what this language does. So, questions from other members, comments? Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, someone had suggested to me perhaps we should include solar thermal production as well. Have you talked about that, Senator Tomasoni, or thought about that? I mean, obviously this company probably isn't going down that path. I assume it's a completely different kind of manufacturing process. But we do happen to have a solar thermal manufacturing company in Minnesota as well.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Cervenek.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, we've had that discussion in the House committee as well, and the answer I think that we would propose is that this is an electricity generation fee that goes into this RDF fund, and solar thermal generates thermal energy, not electricity. And so it's a defining point on what renewable technologies the committee would be open to. Secondly, there is a limited availability of funds, and less than we have in this bill. And if you want to encourage a manufacturer, it's more targeted to PV. And that was, you know, the purpose that Senator Tomasoni is bringing this forward, is to encourage a manufacturer in Minnesota. And so for those two reasons, the definition is fairly narrow and doesn't include solar thermal.
To this point?
No.
All right. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, in terms of money, as we were talking about the whole bill and XL ratepayers and things, if a homeowner was to install a whatever they would need to be somewhat efficient on photovoltaic cells, what would a solar array for an average house cost, so we know how many consumers with this kind of money could be expecting a rebate? Do we have an idea?
Well, the average size system, I believe, Senator Jungbauer, I believe the average size system in the state of Minnesota is about 5 megawatts. So the cost, or five kilowatts. The average cost would be install costs. This would include, you know, not only the panels, but also hiring an electrician, a roofer, to basically install it on somebody's roof. It's usually about $8, maybe seven, between $7 and $8 a watt install is usually what our experience has been. And so you're looking at roughly a $40,000 cost on your average size home.
Senator Jungbauer.
I guess I can do the math and figure out how many homes that would be. I'm trying to think or figure out in terms. I still don't understand quite in terms of how quick this payback happens. Or is it's a one-time, this $5 I'm looking at here is a
It would be, it would supplement.
Mr. Carroll.
Excuse me. Senator Jungbauer. It is designed to supplement the existing upfront rebates, and you have several forms of this. You have a federal tax incentive, which comes in the form of a U.S. Tax credit or a U.S. Treasury grant. It's equivalent to 30% of the installed costs. In addition to that, you would have the rebates. Here in this state, you have a rebate from Xcel. If you're in Xcel territory, I believe it's about $2.24 per installed watt, and I believe that's payable up front. So you take that down. This rebate that we're talking about here in this program would be the difference between $5 a watt and the $2.24 that you would get from the Xcel rebate or any other applicable state rebates.
Senator Jungbauer.
So I guess as this bill moves along, it'd be nice to see a little chart of what the end cost would be for a consumer, because I guess in general I always like to see, you know, technologies move forward, but I'm kind of worried about how we rob Peter to pay Paul sometimes and what the actual end cost is, so how many consumers can actually afford something like this when we're putting it together. Obviously, yeah. We want to make sure that if we do put I think that's been part of the problem with some of the programs we've seen out here. They still have not been put together properly where a consumer could really take advantage of it, or even companies. So I think we need to make sure that whatever we do put together is not, number one, robbing Peter to pay Paul, and the second one is that we're actually getting people to use it. And, you know, in terms of getting more product out there, we understand that as we produce more quantity, the cost per unit goes down, and so we should be getting these things back to the point as soon as possible, being competitive and not having subsidies.
Mr. Carroll, I just want to clarify something. This, you said it was $5 to $7 per watt installed?
For a resident.
And the rebate would be $5 per watt, so we're looking at a net of a cost of $2 a watt, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, it's pretty substantial. Okay. Senator Dibble, you had a question or comment?
Are we done with this line? This is a new subject. Yeah. I just wanted to confirm, there was, in an earlier conversation I had about this bill with the proponents, they rightly wanted to guard against, this is to the A4 amendment, they were open to, you know, not restricting the bill such that it only served their company, which is good, because that's kind of why we're here. We're here to serve larger public policy interests and public benefits. But they rightly expressed concern about opening it up such that it's not actual manufacturing occurring in Minnesota, but maybe some assembly for manufacturing that's really occurring somewhere else, like China. And I just wanted to be sure that this amendment is in that same spirit. I think it is. It seems to be confined enough so that we're talking about actual original manufacture.
Yeah. And that was a concern of mine and theirs as well. And I know when working out that language, and I believe all the proponents here, we've discussed that over the afternoon especially, to make sure that language was specific enough where it dealt with those issues but didn't, you know, open it up where, yes, just assembly, you know, project or companies could come in and put things together. So I think they're all in agreement, unless there's someone that wants to speak in opposition, but I think that's what I understand.
Well, then I'll renew my motion.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble renews his motion for the A4 amendment. Is there any other questions or comments regarding A4 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. All right. Do we have any other testifiers, Senator Tomasoni?
I don't have any, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if somebody else wants to testify.
Is there anyone else here that would like to speak for or against this legislation? Mr. Cannon, welcome to the committee. Please just identify yourself for the record, and the floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Joel Cannon. I'm Chief Executive Officer of 10K Solar. 10K is in the land of 10,000 lakes. We are a research and development company located in Bloomington, developing a very unique and highly efficient approach to solar photovoltaics. I thank you for adopting the motion, because it does extend the language so that my company's products would also be qualified under this program. And it does set a high bar for manufacturing Minnesota. So I just wanted to express my opinion that some level of support can greatly help companies like ours get the foothold that we need. And I also wanted to state that it's a globally competitive product that we're developing here and not just a product to serve Minnesota. And our product is actually, when I leave here today, I'll go back and work on an agreement for delivery of 10 megawatts into New Jersey next year out of a plant in Minnesota. And we're also working with resellers in several countries in Europe, too. So I believe this is an industry that can be a strong export industry for Minnesota. And thanks for your support.
Mr. Carroll, we had spoken earlier, but I know this is not the purview of this committee, but you said you had 30 employees at this point, and you're looking to expand to how many?
We have 30 employees in Bloomington, and we expect the employee threshold to hit close to 100 by the end of this year, actually. Rather aggressive ramp. And I also need to point out on the content piece, you know, nearly every solar manufacturer in the world gets some components from other parts of the world. And that, you know, we do too. We have product that comes from China. I think my counterpart here probably has, you know, cells that come from China. It's just the way that is. But what we found is a way to put the product together here in Minnesota and add the majority of the value to it here. And so that's how we can take a commodity product like a cell and turn it into a globally competitive module.
One point on that, then, just to make sure, Senator Thomas-Sony, that, you know, the language in here is and such, because since there are components that are going to be coming from other countries or other places, that, you know, there's a certain amount of assembly that occurs here, that, you know, is this definition clear enough that
We think it is. We think it, you know, we spent time going back and forth. It's grammatically, it's not the smoothest, but it's we think it addresses it.
And Mr. Carroll, do you have something to add to that? No?
No, I would agree.
All right.
I should also point out that a part of our system is a very unique reflector that includes a material made by 3M that's made in Minnesota. That doesn't fall under this category at all, but it's worth noting that photovoltaic systems are beginning to take on a very broad content. So,
very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, how many square foot coverage do you have to produce 10 megawatts?
Well, 10 megawatts is going to require expanding into the rest of our 75,000 square foot building.
Well, I'm sorry, I might have stated that wrong, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, on the square footage when you're building a solar system,
mm-hmm.
How much square footage of system do you need to produce?
I see. Great.
That's many systems, I'm assuming.
That's many systems. It's rooftop systems, which is the special commercial flat rooftop systems are this particular product offering my company has today. We will offer residential system later this year, but currently that's our target. In New Jersey, you're getting roughly, I believe the number would be about 12 watts per square foot off the top of my head.
I'll just have Senator Carlson do the math.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I might point out that I don't think the New Jersey project gets the Minnesota rebate, though.
It's a good point, Senator Thomas.
Or we're taking the New Jersey money and bringing it here.
We want more jobs here. Okay, well then with that, we'll have Senator Olsen move this bill, I guess. Senator Olsen moves Senate File 2676 as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to Finance, I believe. Any comments or questions on that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Next up will be Senator Dibble, Senate File 2826.
Thanks.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 2826. Mr. Chair and members, Hennepin County is developing a wind energy project at their public works facility, which is located in Medina. And what this bill would seek to do is allow them to become a member of a limited liability company or a shareholder in the corporation for that purpose. And the reason Hennepin County needs to do that is in order to take advantage of production tax credits, investment tax credits, or grants that might be available in lieu of tax credits. Obviously, Hennepin County is a non-taxpaying entity, but is envisioning that they would become a partial shareholder in a corporation that then could take in partners who could take advantage of those particular mechanisms to build this project. Specifically, in order for Hennepin County to do this under authorizing legislation, they have to ask for specific permission to become a part of an LLC. This has been done, as you might recall, in this committee. We've heard from the Minnesota School Districts, Winona County, City of Mountain Iron, and others to do this. That's about the full explanation of the bill. I just wanted to mention the limited liability issues that are mentioned at the very end of the bill. That's really not any change. It's just a restatement of existing liabilities for an entity like Hennepin County. We have Carl Michaud, who's here from Hennepin County, who can help explain a little bit further about the bill. Let me back up one step just to provide a larger context. This is a part of Hennepin County's effort to participate with other counties across the entire country to address environmental issues, renewable energy, causes of global climate change, et cetera. They wouldn't actually use this energy directly at that facility, but rather, you know, how that energy is generated and utilized is already governed as well by state statute. They would sell it to the grid, you know, to the utility company at wholesale, not at retail. But needless to say, that would offset, of course, the energy use that they would overall be participating in their overall energy profile and its implications. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Michaud.
Mr. Michaud, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name's Carl Michaud. I'm the Director of Environmental Services Department for Hennepin County. And I'm very pleased to be here to talk to you about this bill here today, this amendment. We have proposed a wind turbine in the city of Medina, and we were looking at a commercial size wind turbine, 1.5 to 2.2 megawatts in size. And we started this project years ago because there was some interest on the part of the commissioners to take a look to see how we might develop renewable energy that could be used in the county. And we actually engaged the Minnesota Department of Commerce to help us evaluate the wind source out there at the facility many years ago. And we actually put some of the equipment from the state up on the sheriff's radio tower, and we left it up there for 2 years. And based on the information that we received from that data, it showed that it was, you know, the wind resource there would make a project feasible. We also engaged a private company to take a look at that same data, and a company that's been used quite often on the Buffalo Ridge for some of the private developers to take a look at the data and bring some of their own information into this. And they concluded the same thing, that it was feasible for us to actually construct a wind turbine out at this facility. Based on that, we approached the city of Medina, and we worked with them over a period of about a year and a half to address all of the issues and concerns that they had about constructing a wind turbine out there at the facility, you know, addressing the whole noise issue, the visual, the aesthetics. There were numerous other issues that we had to deal with. But we were successful in getting approval from the city council to go ahead and build a wind turbine. So we're looking for this legislation because it would really help us to make this project more economically feasible. And with that, we would generate, again, the purpose is to generate some power for our own use. As Senator Dibble had mentioned, you know, the way the laws are structured here in the state, it actually makes it more practical to sell it to the utility and then buy it back. But with that, it would offset probably about 5% of the total electrical use that the county uses here.
Okay. Senator Dibble, now we've, you know, you said in your testimony now, and we've heard here that, you know, the school districts and counties have been coming forward. You think we're getting to the point where we may need to have a statewide policy instead of individual, you know, local units of government coming forward to ask for this permission? I don't know if we're getting to that point. It seems like we're nearing it at least.
Mr. Chair, we may well be at that point. Deadline is Friday, so don't know if I'm going to take that big bite at this point. I actually think we did kind of address it on a statewide basis for school districts. I'm pretty sure we did kind of a blanket because we had all these number of school districts coming forward, and so I think we established, if I'm not mistaken, kind of an overarching policy for school districts. And there was an attempt to kind of move forward on this front for counties, but I remember that encountered some heartburn, and so it was like, so it was just one county at a time. Then we decided to proceed, but we might be getting there. I don't know.
Okay,
worth considering.
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I believe since Hennepin County would not be using this in a campus-type situation that would be exempt from the rules, that we would need the ubiquitous Excel-type language in this bill also.
I know.
So that we can make sure we're
language.
All on an even and loving playing field.
Senator Dibble.
I'm sorry. Senator Jungbauer said you didn't think we needed.
No, I think we do because it.
Senator Jungbauer,
isn't it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, since even though Hennepin County is trying to offset their own energy use, the only exception that I'm aware of is in that campus type situation.
Oh, Mr. Chair, actually, the Excel language is carried in 373.48.
Yeah.
Nothing in the section modifies the exclusive service territories or exclusive right to serve as provided in section. Et cetera. And that's referenced in this proposal, 373.48.
Exempt that 373.48.
Yeah.
We're not creating an exemption to that.
Correct.
Fair enough, folks.
Did your homework.
Live with that.
Very good. Further questions, comments from members? Is there anyone in the audience here in attendance would want to speak again for or against this bill? Seeing none, then I guess we should move the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2826 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
On that motion, any questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Senator Olsen. Up next is Senate File 2875.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm before you today for 2875, and I have Ron Elwood with to really answer any questions. It's a pretty simple bill, but it's one of those bills that is along the line of consumer protection, and if there's a multiple housing unit where a landlord's not paying the electric bill, it allows for the tenants of the building to either individually or as a group pay for the bill, so, and I'll let Mr. Elwood address that further.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. You may recall couple of years ago, we made some major advancements with respect to protection of tenants in foreclosed properties, and one of those advancements was to ensure that when the bill for the gas, electric, or water was not being paid in a multi-family situation, that the tenants had the right to pay the bill, keep the service on. This bill takes a step before that and makes it explicit in law that the tenants need to be informed when their gas, electric, and water is being disconnected so they can invoke those rights that we gave them a couple of years ago. So it's a pretty basically simple bill. It's making sure that it's just clear in statute that utilities must post the building when a disconnection is taking place. All of the utility companies we've spoken with, and I want to thank all of them The investor owns Xcel and CenterPoint and Minnesota Power, Otter Tail and Merck, as well as the co-ops and the munis, all of which were very cooperative and said this is good public policy. It's what they do and should do anyway, and so we ought to make sure that it's expressly in law that this is what they need to do. One other point I'd like to make is that I think it came from the cities, the municipals in the cities, a suggestion to improve existing law. The current law said that when and if utilities would post the building, they have to post in the building. And it was brought to our attention that sometimes that's actually not possible because they can't get in the building for whatever reason, whether it's access problems or some other legal impediment to getting inside the building. So you'll notice that the language now allows utilities to post in or on the buildings and inconspicuous places. So this gives a little assistance to all the utilities to actually do the right thing.
Mr. Elwood, just a question. Is this something that was as a result of some situation that was occurring that, you know, with a property owner?
Mr. Chair and members, actually, no. It came about, frankly, we were just, you know, looking when we do these reviews and we say, here's what we did, you know, in statute, we actually looked at the law and realized that rather than saying utilities must post, it was permissive and said utilities didn't have to post the building. And it just seemed like that was a poorly worded statute from the get-go when it was drafted. And all the utilities agreed that this ought to be mandatory. This is certainly not something that should be at somebody's whim, and if somebody doesn't want to do it, tenants should always know in advance when they're – because they don't want to – shouldn't come home one day and find their gas, electric, and water shut off without any prior notice.
Absolutely. Senator Olstein.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make a point that Mr. Elwood did his homework quite well. The Minnesota Multiple Housing Association is fine with the bill as it is. So.
Thank you. Questions or comments from members? Is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, seeing none, Senator Olstein.
This bill moved, Mr. Chair, in the House to the consent agenda, so I was wondering if that might be possible here.
Senator Olstein, I think there was a request to see this in Judiciary.
Ooh.
because it's
Mr. Chair, I move that this bill be moved forward to and sent to Judiciary.
On that motion,
because it's landlord-tenant.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. We have one final bill, I believe, Senator Saxhog. Senate File 2827. Okay. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 2827, and I do have an A1 amendment, which should have.
Yeah, I think we have that. Members have that, a copy of that? Okay, the A1 amendment.
Okay, and I'd like to have that moved. The amendment will remove any language relating to the rate rider, which was the provision that caused us to re-refer the bill to this committee.
Okay. Senator Carlson moves the A1 amendment then. Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, this bill as amended is now primarily a tax issue and it will modify certain tax exemptions relating to personal property used for pollution control. So I would hope that someone would move to re-refer this Senate File 2827 to taxes.
Senator Saxhog, could you kind of tell us, I know it's just a tax issue, but will this affect ratepayers in any way in terms of what you're doing here now that it's been amended?
Well, Mr. Chair, with me today is Elizabeth Weifel from the Coalition of Utility Cities, and maybe she could answer that question more effectively than I could.
Ms. Weifel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Weifel. I'm a lobbyist with the firm of Flaherty & Hood representing the Coalition of Utility Cities in this matter. The way that it could affect ratepayers in this situation is that the effect of the bill as amended would be to disallow certain property tax exemptions that could result, that would result in shifting property taxes away from homeowners and commercial real estate to utility companies. Utility companies, if they so choose, could seek to include those property taxes in their rates when they make a rate case.
Okay. And in
but that's they already can recover property taxes under the current rules.
Okay. And Ms. Weifel, this doesn't affect all, utilities here. Isn't there certain cities that are included in this legislation or that it would be affected by it?
This legislation will primarily affect the host communities. The Department of Revenue, as a result of some language in the tax bill last year, ordered a study of the pollution control exemption. And what it found is that it has about $11.8 million worth of tax implications. $11.6 million of those are concentrated in a small group of cities. The ones where that we represent, seven of those that probably have the largest impact as a result of this tax exemption. And those are the Becker, Cohasset, Granite Falls, Hoyt Lakes, Monticello, Oak Park Heights, and Red Wing are seven of the cities that are most affected by this. There are some cities that have where it has a much smaller tax impact. I do have a list of the, I believe there's maybe, okay, sorry. I get to be a wonk sometimes, so I apologize. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Weifel. There are some questions from members of Ms. Weifel's. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saxhog, I know this committee deals with this specifically, but since we're obviously trying to get tax dollars back to our local cities to help them, did we look at, and are you the author of relieving the rest of the personal property tax exemptions around the state that would be a great bonus to our local government units?
Senator Saxhog.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jungbauer, no, I'm not. And, this is very specific, and there's certain host cities. And in fact, I have the administrator of the city of Cohasset with me today, too, who can kind of tell you the story. I mean, as I say, this is maybe a tax issue, but the whole idea is that when I was commissioner of Itasca County, 33% of our tax bill was paid by Minnesota Power, and now we're down to 6%. Someone said, well, geez, you must have had a lot of growth up there. And I said, well, it's really not from 33 to 6%. And I realize there's a lot of different reasons why it went that way, but our host cities are suffering. Yeah.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saxhogan. And I've done a great deal of looking at this bill and really tried to consider it. And on its face, I mean, it seems very commonsensical. And so I actually talked to the utilities in terms of how it affects ratepayers because it does increase rates. So I asked them to try to look at, is there a kind of way to phase it in a short period of time to try to think through some of these things. But then looking at the bigger picture of all the personal property tax exemptions we've given to a lot of things over the years and a lot of it in the energy sector, I just don't think we can just pick and choose to try to figure out what are the best ways to do this right now. And I'm just going to say I'm going to vote against it because I can't, my ratepayers just can't take the hit right now, although I have a host community that comes out way ahead. So either way, in my case, I'm going to tick off somebody, so I don't, it's a hard decision.
I see we have how do I say your name here? Here you go. Ms. Harper from Cohasset is the town you're from. Correct. Welcome to the committee, and if you would like to add something to the testimony.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Harper, and I'm the city administrator in Cohasset, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 2827. It would eliminate the pollution control exemption for electric generating facilities. Minnesota Power is in our backyard on the beautiful Mississippi River. And over the years, 51, if I count them correct, we've had very good relationships with our neighbor, Minnesota Power. We appreciate having them in our community. They are a great employer. We also believe the pollution control exemption unfairly places costs on the residents of Cohasset, all 2,500 plus of them at this point. The citizens in Cohasset and other host cities contend with burdens that other communities do not bear. For a coal-fired plant like the one in Cohasset, there is an accumulation of coal dust throughout the city. I can point you to a particular peninsula, too, that shows it the most. There's increased noise. There's definitely increased train traffic as they train the coal into the city. And all of this comes with its own noise, which affects the residents in Cohasset. There are also many public safety considerations when you host a large power plant that are not present for communities who don't host power plants. In fact, last April, firefighters from Cohasset and Grand Rapids, Minnesota, were called to fight a dangerous coal dust fire at the plant. If you've ever heard about coal dust, it ignites on its own wherever it floats. It took 40 firefighters 13 hours to suppress the fire. Being prepared to fight fires at the plant requires special equipment, and one of them is a special foam unit. And in fact, prior to the fire I just mentioned, Cohasset purchased a $500,000 fire truck in order to be able to do what we did for Minnesota Power at that time. Minnesota Power did donate $10,000 towards the cost of the fire truck, but the citizens of Cohasset paid the other $490,000 cost of the fire truck. We believe that when the coal plant was sited in our community, the trade-off for hosting the plant was the fact that we would be compensated through property taxes for the impact that facility would have on our environment and on our citizens. However, the pollution control exemption significantly erodes the tax base for the city. In Cohasset, the market value of the facility is $220 million. The market value would be $128 million higher without the exemption. That means that the tax burden on all properties is about 11% higher because of the pollution control exemption. So when you talk about ratepayers, Cohasset is part of the ratepaying population. We are particularly concerned about the future impact of this exemption as additional equipment is added to Minnesota Power and the value of old equipment is depreciated. We believe the pollution control equipment is important to everyone in the state of Minnesota. Spreading the cost of this equipment to everyone who benefits is a more fair solution rather than increasing the tax burden on homeowners and businesses and host communities through the pollution control exemption. That has been the ramification of that exemption on Cohasset. We definitely urge your support for Senate File 2827, and I thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Harper. Just a question on these numbers here. $220 million is the current value of the property, and there would be $128 million higher than that for property tax purposes without the exemptions.
Correct.
So I'm trying to understand. So if let's say there were no pollution control devices on there, would that property still be worth $220 million?
Yes.
And
this
so,
is in addition to that.
So then what you're assessing it as is at about $92 million? Is that what you're getting property tax on, that difference between the $128 and the $220?
No. Oh. No, the assessment is on the $220 million.
Okay.
The $128 million that we're not able to assess. It goes with what Senator Saxhog was saying about the decreasing amount that the county gets. You could compare that to the city, too, as it doesn't contribute to the pool that we have, except for the residents in higher property taxes, as you decrease the property taxes that are paid by Minnesota Power.
Okay. As I'm trying to think this through, is that the 128, is that the the value of the pollution control devices and improvements on the facility?
Mr. Chair, I think that Elizabeth could probably do a better job of answering that.
Ms. Weifel.
That is the value of the difference between the pollution control equipment and what is considered taxable. The important thing to remember is that the plant can't run the plant without that equipment. And even though it's pollution control equipment, that doesn't mean it's the only thing that it's doing. Sometimes it can, offer safety benefits. Sometimes it can offer operational benefits. You wouldn't operate a plant without this sort of equipment. So it would be sort of artificial to say that, you should be exempting this piece, but, leaving the rest of it on. You know, one of the other problems, and I think Ms. Harper, referred to this, is that through a variety of changes over the years, the value of the original equipment continues to go down because, it continues to depreciate. As new equipment is added to these facilities, a lot of times it is pollution control equipment. So the equipment helps to keep the plant running, but they're able to exempt it off. Senator Saxhog mentioned, the big difference in terms of the share of property values. I think it's really, we have one other chart that was in there. Really important to note that property taxes for utilities have stayed pretty stable. This chart right here shows kind of the difference between 2002, what the utility sector was paying in property taxes, and 2009. During that time period, residential homestead, 87.9% increase. Commercial industrial, 54.7% increase. There's been an increase in a lot of values. During that same time period, the utilities have stayed very flat. There's a number of different reasons, but one of those reasons, for example, was that there was some changes made to the way that this property is valued. And so now the original equipment, there is no cap on depreciation, so the value of these plants, aside from the pollution control equipment, continues to depreciate down, so the value continues to go down, which affects all of the taxpayers in this area. As you can see, there are some fairly complex tax issues, and this is why in some ways we do think that this is an important discussion for the tax committee. But getting back to your original question, that I just don't think with these cities you can separate out and say, even if the exemption wasn't in place, you'd have this value, because a lot of times, like I said, you couldn't operate the plant without that equipment. It's not that easily separable. It's just that they get this piece on there. I know there was a big addition out at the Oak Park Heights facility in the last couple of years. Large portions of that were kept off of, the tax rolls because it was considered pollution control equipment. However, the equipment doesn't just, help with pollution control. At the same time, it can improve efficiency. It can do other things. But as long as it's primarily, under the statute, as long as it's primarily directed towards pollution control, it's kept out. Things that support it, keep it out. Again, and that starts to get into some of the tax policy questions of, is this something that we think should be taxed or not? How should it be handled? Should this small base of population in Cohasset be handling the cost of that, or should it be spread out through the ratepayers throughout the entire state?
Okay, thank you. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Weifel?
Weifel.
It's German. I'm not certain how you say that it's being spread out across the taxpayers of a small city. Did you receive taxes from this at one time, and then it was exempt later? Well, I thought that what happened was that equipment was placed on, and it was tax exempt at that time.
Madam Chair. What our concern is here is that the reason we need this exemption to go into place is because of, it's outdated, but B, other changes that have happened with respect to valuation that continue to drive down the value of these plants. As I mentioned, that there were changes about 2 or 3 years ago to the way these plants are valued. And so, value that was originally there, equipment that was installed when the plants were originally built, there's no cap on depreciation, and that continues to go down. If they add new equipment and it happens to have a pollution control, to update the plant, if they add new equipment and that has a pollution control element to it, then they are able to get the exemption for it, even if it does serve other functions. And so this is kind of a balancing out for these cities because the value of these plants has decreased over the years because of other changes.
I just one follow-up question on that, and we don't want to get too far off track, but on the exemption on that portion, so there was an exempt portion for the pollution control devices or upgrades. Is that depreciated over time, or is that exemption amount stay the same from the time it's installed in perpetuity?
My understanding is, at least as far as how they value it go, they don't the depreciation factor doesn't get added in until after they take the exempt portion out. So it's just something that's not looked at. Does that make sense?
It's a tax question, but I'm just curious. Okay. Any other questions from members of these testifiers right now? All right, because I know we have a couple more folks that would like to testify, and I'm assuming even though there's been an amendment on this that you still would like to testify. So at this point, we'd like to bring up Rick Lancaster. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Rick Lancaster. I'm Vice President of Generation at Great River Energy. We're a not-for-profit cooperative. We serve 28 distribution co-ops in Minnesota, serve 600,000 retail consumers, about 1.7 million people in the homes we serve. The exemption that is the subject of this bill was one of the things that made it attractive to convert our Elk River power plant in 1989 from being a coal-burning power plant to being a plant that burns refuse-derived fuel, which I call garbage. The bill would increase our cost and thus our rates to our members by $760,000 per year. Our rates are set by our board of directors, and the rates are adjusted annually. So the language that was deleted doesn't affect us, but the language that remains in the bill would affect us. We're trying to hold down our rates in these difficult times, and this wouldn't help. I want to make a comment also about the energy policy behind burning garbage instead of burning other fuels such as coal, which is what this plant used to burn. Garbage buried in landfills generates methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas that's 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And although landfills try to recover methane, the United States Environmental Protection Agency estimates that only about 75% of the methane that's generated in landfills is actually recovered in those landfills that have methane recovery systems. So according to the EPA, a half a ton of carbon dioxide equivalent greenhouse gases is avoided for every ton of municipal solid waste that's burned in power plants such as ours. So we this year will burn about 230,000 tons of garbage. We avoid 115,000 tons of CO2 equivalent each year. So my summary is that this is a bad thing for us and our members. It increased our rates by $760,000 a year. It's also, as it affects us, because we have a garbage-burning power plant, it's contrary to good environmental policy. Thank you very much.
And your testimony is that if this language were in place prior when you were looking at that new plant, the garbage burner, you wouldn't have pursued that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can't say it quite like that. What I said was this is one of the things that made it attractive to convert the plant from coal to garbage. It was part of the deal that was in place at the time.
Okay.
It wasn't the only thing.
Right. So it could have. You still could have gone forward, but that did make it a little more attractive.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from members? Ms. Testifier. Senator Sharon.
Mr. Lancaster, I'm trying to get my head around this as well. And it seems to me that as I listen to the testimony, I'm reducing it, and I'm wondering if this is a fair statement, that what we're talking about here, all these values that we're talking about, encouraging pollution equipment to be put in these plants, reducing emissions, all good things that we want to have happen. But the argument seems to be down to how and what is the size of the geographic area or the number of persons that are responsible for paying for that. Is it the ratepayers who benefit from that and should be built into the rates? Or do you expect the communities, because the depreciation on the old equipment causes the property taxes to go down and they can't collect property taxes on improvements that are connected to pollution, so that the costs then really get absorbed by a smaller tax base and is put on property taxes? That's how I am hearing this argument, and I'm wondering if that's accurate from your perspective.
Mr. Lancaster.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the way this played out in our case is the equipment was not there before we converted to refuse-derived fuel. The tax exemption was there, so part of our economic analysis in deciding whether to convert to refuse-derived fuel was the knowledge that the equipment would not be taxed according to the provisions that are then and are now still in place. So there was no revenue that was lost by the city or the county as a result of what we've done.
Senator Sharon.
But I think what I am understanding is that as equipment depreciates, and because there's not a cap on depreciation, the values against which property taxes are collected are going down. And therefore, you're asking host communities, or if we continue, what the host communities are saying is you're asking them to pay for benefits that really should be, that are coming to a larger group of people than just those property taxpayers, and that they're paying an extraordinary burden for achieving these goals that we all share about reducing pollution. Is that true?
Mr. Lancaster.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you're really outside of my area of expertise here. I'm not a tax expert, so I don't know about the decline in the value of the property, so I really can't comment knowledgeably on that.
Mr.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I think the argument is backwards, and I think they've twisted the argument, because really there was no tax in the first place. And yes, this should be borne by more than just the ratepayers or the taxpayers in one community. It should be borne by the whole state. But it's not something like that they've lost, the communities. They never had it in the first place. And so now I know they're running around trying to find more taxes because local government aid has been cut. Everything's been cut. So they're grasping everywhere to find some additional revenue for cities. But I don't think it's fair for them to grab it from something that the state imposed. We continually are raising our rates because of the mandates that we've placed on all these utilities. Again and again and again, especially since 2007. But I don't think that the city should capitalize on it because we've required them to put on pollution control equipment. There is no profit to the utility company for having that pollution control equipment on there. They'd gain no revenue from it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon.
Well, Senator Solon, you know, the fact that you're saying that we haven't lost anything, and I'm referring now to the host cities or the counties that host these power plants, I just don't think is correct. We've been talking about accelerated depreciation. That's what we've been talking about, the loss of value. But I think we all know that there's been property tax cuts that the power companies have taken advantage of. And I don't, you know, more power to them. And I think the Public Utilities Commission has helped them out on that end, too. You know, and again, we're talking then about the host cities and the host counties being the ones that take the burden of this. And it's gone down. I mean, when I see that 33% of the tax bill in Itasca County was paid by the Minnesota Power, and that now it's 6%. I mean, that's not just accelerated depreciation, which is in my mind is very legitimate. It's tax cuts that somebody got, and the rest of our taxes were going up.
Senator Sharon and then Senator Dibble.
I forgot my question, Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, and I take, interestingly, a slightly different view than Senator Pretner Solon. And, you know, I was the chief author of the Mercury Emission Reduction Act that required much of this pollution to be installed. You know, at a time we allowed for rate recovery, you know, in the property tax exemption. It's been a part of that. But my view is that, you know, this is something that, you know, as equipment has become more commercially available, as technology has advanced, in the outset we provided some of these incentives. It was taking on some stuff that utilities weren't previously doing. But I think an examination of the facts shows that, particularly the property tax exemption, really has not played a significant role in whether or not utilities do this. It's really, you know, the direction of the state and the goal of public policy. And it's not as if, though, failure to install this equipment means that someone doesn't pay. We all pay societally. We pay in the form of diminished environmental outcomes, our environmental consequences, public health is a significant cost that we all bear. So it means that the utility company and, you know, by consequence, you know, those who pay for power kind of get to kind of in a less direct fashion spread that cost and the effect of the pollution out more broadly societally. And I also am compelled by the argument that, you know, local host communities do bear a disproportionate burden for hosting facilities like this. And my perspective, of course, comes from the airport. And, you know, the communities that surround the airport bear a pretty significant cost on behalf of the state for something that serves a larger public good. And while that's never been really recognized very well by the state or by the airport's commissioner or anyone else, at least we finally received some consideration for mitigating the effect within our own homes. That was the result of years of effort and a lawsuit that finally got settled, and we're finally getting there. So, you know, we do need to think about our responsibility to those communities that host facilities that we all benefit from. We heard about the coal dust and, you know, the other impacts in Cohasset. I mean, that's real.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sharon.
I do remember now what I was going to say. Let me just, in context, say that in my professional life, one of the things I was trained to do is to stop creating my own answers to what people were saying before they quit talking. So I stop my own process to listen to what somebody else is saying, and then I can't remember what it was I was going to say. But Senator Dibble reminded me, and that is that I think that we do a lot of really great things in this committee to encourage activities for our power companies to meet our energy efficiency goals, in that we want to do incentives to help them do that. What we don't do here, and what we don't do in lots of places, that I was trying to get passed in another separate piece of legislation, was to calculate out the costs to local units of government. Because when we take all of these various forms of tax policy and then change an element within it without really thinking about its implications on something like the host communities, eventually, a combination of complex things, cutting local government aids, not capping depreciation, giving tax breaks for any improvements that would come in terms of equipment, has an impact on local units of government. And they're coming to us more and more now to try to get us to understand that that's happening. I don't think it's an opposition to the goals of this committee, but they're raising the concerns about how our policies are impacting them locally. And I think we do need to listen to that. Maybe that's not the right function here. As they're saying, it ought to go to tax committee where they can take a look at the complex issues that are here. But I do have an ear, and of course I have an affection for local units of government.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there's been a very good discussion. Except I have to go back to what Senator Jungbauer said about how this opens up this whole argument. And I just thinking in a broader aspect of the the local host communities, and they have these power plants here, and I'm thinking in the broader scale of hog setups, and I'm thinking really broad here, how the exemptions could keep going on, and it begs the question, yes, what is the effect on these communities? How many people do they employ? What kind of property taxes are they paying? I mean, I'm sure there's some areas of the state that would love to have something like this in their corner of the world. So I'm just very apprehensive. It just seems like we were two steps forward, one step back with this type of legislation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lancaster. We have two more testifiers. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Sanjim, did you have something?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe just a comment. I'm just trying to think about this in the simplest of terms. We sat here a half hour ago talking about and ultimately voted to subsidize solar renewable energy in the name of a cleaner environment, I think generally speaking, and so now we're sitting here talking about considering pulling a tax exemption on pollution control equipment also in place, granted by a previous legislature, I suppose, I don't know when. Also in the name of, but also existing in the name of a cleaner environment. So on one hand, we did one thing, and on the other hand, we're going to kind of go the other way, maybe. It's just a rhetorical question, but I'm sitting here a little kind of generally confused.
I think that's shared by several here. I had a question. Senator Dibble, we, in the mercury controls, now, is that when this thing, tax exemption was inserted, but that was further back, right?
2006, 2007.
Yeah, I don't believe this property tax exemption was specifically a part of that bill, but certainly the expedited rate recovery, the ability to include additional kinds of property of pollution control equipment could be folded, as well as efficiency improvements to the plant could all be folded into the requirements of the mercury emission reductions. Combined with the rate recovery, I don't think the property tax exemption was, personal property tax exemption was a part of that bill. I don't know where this personal, it's always been kind of a little mystery in tax, where the personal property tax
let's bring up
energy
Larry
facilities comes from.
Sorry, let's bring up Larry Johnson from SEMPA. And Rick Evans, did you want to come up too as well? And we'll, our last two testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this. I would like to speak briefly on our opposition to the bill and hit two major concerns that we've seen with regard to this. The first one is the increased cost to consumers. I'll talk about that in a minute. And very much like Senator Sendrum, we're trying to get our head around the question he raised as well, because actually this is going to increase costs for environmental improvements. And in our opinion, we do see that as kind of juxtaposed to where Minnesota policy has historically been. So first of all, if the exemption is removed, electric consumers will see increased bills. SEMPA, of course, is a not-for-profit wholesale generation and transmission company serving our 18-member municipal utilities throughout the state of Minnesota. So elimination of this exemption, in fact, will fall directly on us, which will fall on our members, which is going to fall on their consumers in those cities. And with all due respect to the host cities, our communities are cities too, and they're suffering from some of the same issues that everyone else is in terms of LGA. It's just that at the moment we're talking about shifting the particular cost from one group of cities to another, if you will. That cost is estimated for SEMPA to be in the neighborhood of about 1.2 to 1.5, about twice what GRE was seeing. And, of course, SEMPA is probably serving across both our residential and commercial industrial customers, probably about 110,000, 115,000 customers. So this can be significant. Our quick estimates are that this would likely result in about 0.75% increase in rates. 0.75% may not seem like a very large number to people. But particularly in these times, we've got families struggling to make ends meet. We frankly think that it is. And if it were an isolated incident, Maybe that would be one thing, but we really think that this isn't isolated. This is simply the last in a series of significant costs related to us making investments in terms of the environment, and that gets us to the point that several people have pointed out as well. Eliminating this exemption, in our mind, increases the cost of environmental investments, and doesn't that seem contrary to what we typically try to do and talk about in this committee? I mean, typically we're trying to look for ways to make environmental investments, reduce emissions, and find the cheapest possible way to do that. This is a much different situation for us, where we're talking about an action that's actually going to increase the cost of those investments. Since 2001, I've been in front of this committee a lot, because it seems like every session we're talking about some particular new initiative or policy initiative to reduce emissions that we want to discuss, you know, kind of starting with the REO-RES, which became one of the most significant in this country in terms of its aggressiveness. We've got aggressive new SIP targets that we put in place. Somebody referenced the Minnesota Mercury Reduction Act. We've had prohibitions against building coal plants in Minnesota, or probably more to the point of the discussion here, even importing more than 50 megawatts of energy that's produced by a coal plant outside the state of Minnesota. During the same time frame, EPA has significantly stepped up their efforts in terms of regulation on this, and we've got climate change legislation looming around the corner. Now, that's not to imply that any of these things and these efforts are not very worthy. In fact, I think most of you in the room know that SMPA takes that very seriously. I don't know if you've seen this news release, but it's from the DOE that talks about SMPA being ranked fourth in the country in terms of the amount of wind for the percentage of retail sales. Next week, we happen to get our third National Energy Star Award. We take these things very seriously. We've invested in the initiatives that we've talked about earlier here. But as we go through that, the investments, in fact, will all come at a cost. Our investment in our wind power efforts, be they notable, have probably added to about a 5 to 6% rate increase for the agency. Our portion of the Mercury Reduction Act has added a little bit over a percent in terms of doing that. With our partners, Xcel at Sherco 3, we've added 70 new low NOx burners, probably about another $6, $7 million from the agency's standpoint, roughly probably close to a 3% rate issue. And controls out there to fine-tune that system to make sure that we're consistently monitoring and tweaking it to make it as clean as possible, about another $10 million, so close to another, like, 5% number. Again, you know, these are all worthy investments, and we tend to sit down here and evaluate each and every one of these proposals as an isolated event because that's how they come to us. I mean, that's what happens. And so we talk about the benefits, and they're all extremely worthy, and on a one-by-one basis, probably the costs of many of them are not too significant. But in a cumulative sense, at some point in time, it adds up. And again, with these climate change challenges around the corner, we believe that eliminating this exemption and making environmental investment more expensive sends exactly the wrong signal at the worst possible time. We're talking about how we can make huge investments at some point in time in carbon capture and sequestration. We have all kinds of issues around the corner that relate to this. We're just having a hard time at the agency understanding why it appears to be good public policy to, in fact, increase the cost of environmental controls. So we'd respectfully ask that you'd vote against this particular bill.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Let's hear from Mr. Evans, then we'll open up to questions again.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of handouts, if somebody could. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Evans. I'm with Xcel Energy, and I'm going to approach this from a little different point of view, perhaps, than the other testifiers have. There is an important energy policy decision that you're making here today, and that decision is how much should host communities be compensated for being host communities? Several members of the committee have raised that question today, and it's a good and important question. In order to understand that, first I need to clarify something, because I'm not sure that Senator Sharon got the answer to her question, and I'm going to try one more time. When we add any kind of equipment to the plant, whether it be pollution control equipment or safety equipment or new generation equipment, the full cost of adding that is borne by our ratepayers. That is part of our rate cases every single time. The question we're addressing here is how much of that property, real property and personal property, is subject to a tax that's paid to the local community. That's really the question we're asking about. So we shouldn't get confused with the idea that somehow communities are paying for pollution control equipment. They are not. Our ratepayers pay every dime for pollution control equipment and every other piece of equipment that we put in. So the question is, how much do host communities receive by virtue of being host communities? And if I can start with the line graph that we passed out, this one here. It's important for the committee to understand that, like every other property owner in Minnesota, utilities pay real property taxes. For the land and the buildings that we own in the communities, we pay real property taxes. And for XL Energy, the bottom line on this graph indicates the amount that we pay in real property taxes in total for our system in Minnesota. But utilities, and only utilities in the state of Minnesota, pay personal property taxes. No other business in the state of Minnesota pays personal property taxes. And the second line, the upper line on this graph, indicates the total amount of taxes that we pay to our host communities. And so the difference between those two lines, the space between those two lines, represents the money that we pay to host communities that no other business located in their community would have to pay. Only us, only because we're utilities. And it's that difference that has come to be the measure of the benefit paid to host communities to compensate them for the burden of being host communities. And that line includes all of the personal property that we have at our plant, except for property that is exempt, which is the pollution control equipment that we're talking about here. Another way to look at it is to look at the bar graph. If you had $50 million worth of residential property in your community, that combined group of property owners would pay $470,000 in property tax. If you had a $50 million plant with $100 million of equipment that manufactured chemicals in your community, you would receive $1,460,000 because they don't pay personal property tax on that equipment. But if you're a utility company with a $50 million piece of property plus $100 million of equipment, just like the commercial industrial plant here, we will pay $3,460,000 to that community. That is the amount, that difference is essentially the compensation to the community for receiving or for having the utility property in their town. Now, what we're arguing about here today is whether or not, in addition to this, we should add the personal property that is pollution control equipment. In the case of XL Energy, that would add $11 million per year to our overall bill. It would be an $11 million increase to the money that's paid to the communities as compensation for having the utility there. The money, as others have pointed out, rather that equipment has always been exempt. It's not been subject to the personal property tax. So this is, in essence, a decision by this committee that host communities are not being compensated sufficiently with the difference between these two lines and that they need more. The other thing I'd like to point out, at least in the case of XL, because there's been some talk here about depreciation, there is depreciation. One of the problems, I suppose, with paying for this compensation out of a personal property tax is that personal property, unlike real property, depreciates. That's not our decision. That's the decision that the state made back when they decided that the personal property tax was the way to compensate the communities. Personal property depreciates. But I will tell you something else that happens at these plants. We install new equipment that's not pollution control equipment. For example, at our nuclear plants, when we do our uprate at our nuclear plants, When I do our upgrade at the Prairie Island plant, we will be installing new turbines and new steam generators that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and that will be personal property taxable by the community. And by 2017, we expect to be paying the Red Wing community not the $4 million we're paying them today, but $9 million. Why? Because our plant is worth that much more after we do the upgrade. So I think this is an important energy policy issue, and I think the committee needs to understand and needs to think about how much host communities should get. And it's a very complicated issue, one we would like to engage. And I know Senator Sharon has a bill where she's looking at some of these very same issues looking down into the future, and that's a really important issue. But it is an energy policy issue, and our current position, of course, is that we think we're paying a sufficient compensation to the communities for the burden that they bear by having us there. This, by the way, doesn't have anything to do with the fact that we employ 800 people in their communities, the fact that, you know, all the other things that we think we contribute to that community. So I would urge the committee to not move this bill along. I'd urge the committee, if we want to have a serious conversation about reasonable compensation to host communities, let's have it. We'd welcome that. We'd like to participate fully. But we think that this bill is moving in the wrong direction. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Evans, I do have a couple of questions, well, for either of you, Mr. Johnson or Mr. Evans. So rate recovery on these, there is an accelerated or rate recovery on the pollution control devices. So at some point, those upgrades are paid off by the ratepayers. Is that correct? You recover your costs for those items over some period of time by adding it to the rates.
Yeah, right. Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And so, but at some point, once those upgrades have been paid for, you're still getting the tax exemption. Is that correct? So you're still getting the property tax or exemption that we're talking about here. That continues into perpetuity.
Well, if
even
Mr.
though it's
Chair,
paid off,
the value of the equipment when it's installed or the cost of the equipment is paid by the ratepayers through a normal rate case or through a rider, depending on what kind of equipment it is.
Right.
The value of that equipment is taxed, but because it's personal property, not real property, it does depreciate. So it becomes less valuable, just like any other equipment is depreciated. That's the way the personal property tax works. If we install new equipment, however, then that new equipment is at full value and starts to appreciate from them. So it's not a fixed figure.
I guess I don't know if we're falling the same way. I'm trying to understand that there's a tax exemption for the pollution control devices right now. So it's like an incentive to go ahead and do these things. But at the same time, you're also going to recover all the costs you put into it in addition to getting the tax exemption. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then, my other question, two other questions is, if you do a pollution control upgrade on a, say, coal-fired power plant, does that make the plant itself more efficient in any way?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not in and of itself.
Okay.
When we added a significant amount of pollution control equipment to our King plant, we also did upgrades that increased the output from the plant, but they were not the same as the pollution control equipment.
Okay. And then I guess the final thing that I'm seeing based on what you've been telling me and the arguments here is that it's about whether the environmental impact on the host community, you know, how significant that is if the compensation they're receiving from having the utility in the community, whether it's the employment or the fact that they do get the property tax, you know, from having the facility there, is sufficient to cover for any environmental impacts. And I guess I don't know if we can quantify that. That's, you know, because obviously those that are next to the plant are going to experience something higher than those that are, you know, 50 miles away. And I don't know if that's something we can actually determine. But I the other question being, does at what point do we say that the tax exemption is, you know, you've gotten the incentive to do that, and should that continue on? And I don't know if that's a purview of this committee or not. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair Dahl. I have a couple of questions, if it would be okay. One is for Senator Saxog. I want to go back now to the request in front of this committee. It was, would you say again, are you wanting us to re-refer there was a request to re-refer this to taxes. Would you go over what it is that you're asking us to do again?
Senator Saxhawk.
Well, the
by removing the language.
If you take your original bill before we put the amendment on, that was an approval of a rate schedule providing for an adjustment of charges to recover. Well, you can just read what it is, and that was the reason that it was drawn into this committee. And so, with that being taken off, I was assuming that it could go to the tax committee.
Thank you, Senator Saxhawk. The reason I'm asking that, Chair Dahl, is because of the nature of this conversation, the complexities around all the various decisions that have been made about tax policy, what would increase and lower this a personal property tax, all of the changes and the revisions that have occurred are not in this committee, and why depreciation is set as it is and why there isn't a cap. That's really all better understood, I think, because of the participation in the tax committee than here. So since those are the issues, I guess I'm wondering why we would not honor that request and let those issues be re-referred to the tax committee.
However, Chair. Senator Sharon, if this tax exemption's removed, then, you know, that does, it's going to increase the cost, is what I understand, and then that will be borne by the ratepayers. Okay.
Yes, and the tax issue related to that, I think, was well articulated here by everybody. It is the issue of us thinking about who pays for what our public policy and our vision is about pollution control and the expectations we are establishing on our utilities. How are those paid for? Is there a limit to which we can tolerate that? And how broad assessment base should be established in order to pay for that? And I think that what brings these kinds of things to this committee is that tax issue and not necessarily the issues related to environmental protection.
Okay. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I couldn't disagree with you more. I think the issue is really about energy policy and about whether we give incentives for pollution control or not when it comes to reducing mercury and SOx and NOx and carbon emissions and supporting our renewable energy mission and our, everything that this committee has been working on for the past many years. So I think it's an integral part of what we do here, and I think that it's not just tax policy.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Prettner-Solon said it very well.
Further questions, comments?
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
I
Johnson.
Guess to get at your question, I'd kind of reiterate what Rick said. If we'd like to have a discussion about that, we'd be happy to participate in that discussion. But I guess a couple things come to mind, and your direct question was, you know, is it reasonable compensation for the environmental impacts to that host community? I guess my simple question to that would be, is making environmental improvements more expensive a solution to your question in any form or fashion? I mean, if what we're talking about are the local communities being adequately compensated for the environmental impacts of being the host, mm-hmm. you know, is making environmental improvements more expensive a solution to that? And I guess I would tend to think the answer to that is probably no.
Well, and my thinking with this is that we, you know, everyone benefits from the fact that we have pollution control, not just the host city. You know, or town, and so is it something that, you know, all the ratepayers should pay? They pay for it anyway. I mean, they're going to pay for those pollution control devices, and at some point, those things have been paid for, and those benefits continue to go to all ratepayers. And yet, you know, should we be looking at that at some point? The host community now should be able to look at the full value of the plant now that all the costs have been recovered, to compensate maybe for the fact that they are the host and they are probably still experiencing more of the environmental impacts than those further away.
Mr. Chair, that's an important question. I think it hits right at Senator Solon's comment as well, that is an environmental issue. It leads me to believe, you know, when you look at who benefits and who pays in the state, your point and others' points are well taken. All the citizens in Minnesota benefit from that. But would that suggest to me that Southern Minnesota Power would be better off producing all of our energy in some state other than Minnesota and importing it to Minnesota so that we weren't dealing with those issues? You know what I'm saying? Because there will be companies here. There's energy in the state that isn't subject to the host, you know, community investment.
Further questions? Okay. Well, I think Senator Rosen.
I'm sorry, I didn't have to comment again. Thank you. And I think Mr. Johnston brings up a very good point that I did want to make, because two things. These host communities have a business in their locale, and this is a business. I mean, it's a regulated business, but it's still a business. And so we need to be respectful of that. And any expansion of the industry in the state is probably going to be mitigated because of increased costs on environmental control. It seems like we're just going backwards. And then I added up your percentages, Mr. Johnson, on all the things that we've done, and the percent increase to the ratepayers is 14 to 15% increase. Well, you add more on top of that, on top of your businesses, just your small businesses, and we're pricing ourselves out of any competitive advantage at all to our neighboring states or anybody that would like to come in and settle in Minnesota. So we need to really be thoughtful about this, and I appreciate the discussion.
Senator Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, I'm confused now.
Oh, good.
I was. The points are well taken, and is this a good idea then?
Senator Mr. Johnson. Or Mr. Revens, whichever.
Yeah,
then
who you're
asking. Senator,
I guess I'd ask the utilities if it sounds like I'm not getting a clear message here. Is this a good idea? This bill, should we pass this?
We would request that you would not pass this bill.
Why?
Because it adds unduly to the cost of trying to clean up the environment, in our opinion.
So all these points that are well taken aren't well taken? I just want to be clear as to what your position is. It's sometimes hard for me to tell.
Well, speaking for Xcel, and you know, we also don't favor the passage of the bill. The reason we don't is because we have a current scheme of compensating host communities for the burden of having the plant there, and this simply increases that cost without any analysis of whether, in fact, their needs are greater or their needs have increased or their costs have gone up. The question is, if the state sets a policy for compensating host communities through the personal property tax, which is what they have done, if you're going to increase that, it seems to me there ought to be a reason that somehow some evidence that the host communities are not being fairly compensated. We would love to have that discussion. We don't think that's the discussion that we've had.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, I've heard offers several times to have that discussion about what would be fair compensation for the host communities. And Senator Saxhog, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be appropriate to lay your bill over so that you could have those conversations.
Senator Saxhog.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Solon, for the offer. And I'd love to have that discussion, but only after I take it. I'd like to see the bill re-referred to taxes and so that we meet a deadline and then we can discuss it again.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I would have a hard time voting for your bill as it is, Senator Saxhog. And I I think that there probably is a role for some type of compensation to the host community, but I'm not sure this is the way to go about it, at least in the way that it affects our energy policy at this time.
Senator Saxoff.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, I do appreciate it, honestly. And yes, there probably is room for a discussion, because there's no question about it that, as you say, if the issue here is that we don't want to do it with pollution control equipment, because indeed we're trying to encourage that, there's no question in my mind that the host communities are not being fairly compensated by the investor-owned power companies. So I'd like to have that discussion.
Senator Sharon.
I didn't want to leave a complete discussion from Mr. Evans, who was talking about a public policy that would be passed that would increase payments to local communities without applying that against some criteria for need. That goes both ways, that we have had a number of public policies that have reduced payments to local communities have not even considered the implications of that on local communities. So.
Well, Senator Saxog, I'm also, led to feel that the advice of Senator Prettner-Solon is not is a good idea, and that this is an energy policy issue that we should be considering a little more fully. So I'm not sure where the members are at this point, but I think maybe doing a little more work on it wouldn't be a bad recommendation, because I'm not sure we have enough support. I know I'm not really feeling strongly about this either at this point, knowing that I need a little more information on how this is going to impact those cities, as well as what are those environmental effects, and what's the proper amount of compensation. And we let it go from here to the tax committee. It starts to have effects on this committee, but we don't have the purview to make those decisions after this. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Solon, so what's your recommendation?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, I suggest that you take the offer of the utilities to sit down with them and have a discussion about what would be appropriate compensation. And maybe we can't work it out this year, but certainly you could do some work and bring it back next year.
All right.
Senator Saxog.
Mr. Chair, somebody else is going to have to take the action. I respectfully bow to Chairman.
Right. Do we have a motion here from the...
Just lay it over.
We want to just lay it over? Yeah. Well, we're going to lay the bill over then, Senator Saxog. And for further consideration. Any other comments from the members? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. With that, I think...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Again, on